Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for the next hour of medical news, health, science, debate, dialogue, questions, and answers all around healthcare and science in the news. So fasten your seatbelts and stay tuned. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I wanted to start out today with one email that I got this week from Sharon in Grass Valley, California. Sharon writes, "My 95-year-old mom recently started on Bistolic, Tecterna, and X-Forge for high blood pressure, 175 over 70. It's been very effective, bringing her down to 120 over 70. In November, she had a pacemaker placed for her very low and erratic heart rate. Now, two questions. How does the beta blocker interact with the pacemaker? Part of the effect of the beta blocker is to slow the heart rate. Does that interfere with the pacemaker, which is set at 70 beats? And these medications are very expensive. Is there another option?" First of all, Sharon, I want to answer your direct question about the pacemaker and the beta blocker. There really is not an interaction. The pacemaker trumps the beta blocker. Beta blockers have several effects, one of which is to stabilize the heart rhythm. So if a person is having extra beats or has an irritable heart, which I suspect may be the case with your mom, it's used to prevent a person from dropping into a rapid rhythm, which a pacemaker will not prevent in most situations. But the pacemaker itself, being set at 70, will prevent her heart rate from going below 70. So effectively, the most common problem with beta blockers, which is the slow heart rate leading to dizziness in the elderly when they stand up, is pretty much blocked by the pacemaker. Not completely, but pretty much. So that's not a concern. But as to your second question, I was quite taken aback by the description of a 95-year-old woman being started on Bistolic, which is a new beta blocker, new branded beta blocker, Tecterna, which is an angiotensin receptor blocker and has a second action of direct plasma renin blockade. And I'm not really sure what the mechanism of that is. Renin is very important in being released from the kidney and helping control fluid dynamics and blood pressure. So the physiology there makes Tecterna kind of a unique drug, a new category, if you will. And the last drug, X-Forge, which is a combo drug. And those of you who are listeners to the show know I'm kind of against combo drugs because I see them for the most part as repackaging by pharmaceutical companies of drugs that are available more cheaply so that they can keep their patent and keep making lots of money. X-Forge is a combination of Norvasc, which is amlodipine, and Valsartan, which is an ARB, another angiotensin receptor blocker. So I'm a little concerned about that drug combination because we have a 95-year-old lady taking essentially four drugs, two of which are redundant. The Valsartan and the ARB and the Tecterna are essentially the same drug category. So that's redundant. And one doesn't like to do that in medicine. We doesn't like to give two different drugs of the same class, particularly when they're expensive. But we'll come back to just good medicine. If cost were no object, I would still object to that combination. I would also say that X-Forge has the other ingredient in it, amlodipine, is available as a generic. And so you could get, I think, a cleaner, more effective approach by eliminating the X-Forge and substituting the amlodipine. Now, admittedly, your mother has, I'm sure, a cardiologist. There may be some very specific reasons that are escaping my sphere of knowledge of her case that mean that these are the perfect drugs for her. But it's also kind of coincidental that if I were to go to my drug cupboard right now and look on the shelves, I would find Bistolic, Tecterna, and X-Forge because all three of these drugs are currently being promoted rather heavily by the pharmaceutical companies. And that means that it's easy to just walk to the cupboard, get the drugs, and hand them to the patient. That's what the pharmaceutical companies want us to do, admittedly, but that's not necessarily what we should be doing for our patients. Bottom line here on this particular situation is that I see a complication that could potentially be brewing with the use of the two ARBs. I see the use of an expensive medication where a cheaper medication could be used. And I just want to roll this over, and it will first seem like a non sequitur, but you'll see where I'm going with this, to a letter that was sent to the Congress by the American College of Physicians last week. This was a series of recommendations around healthcare reform. What the letter said was, we need to support and increase primary care physicians. We need to facilitate the use of primary care physicians to coordinate and critique care. For example, a patient like this might be seeing a cardiologist and therefore not come in to see her primary care doctor. And when I did get a chance to sit down and look at these drugs, it would cross my mind that these were redundant and we could get the same effect at a cheaper cost. That's the job of the primary care doctor, to use those practical things. But currently, we have a system that completely doesn't support it, and we need to actively increase the number of primary care doctors, and that includes family physicians and primary care internal medicine. These doctors are trained to practice medicine differently. They're trained to practice a primitive form of functional medicine. In other words, disease management, thinking in terms of what are the financial and physical and other barriers to compliance, not just write the prescription, hand it to the patient, and tell them to come back in 3 months. Primary care doctors who have adequate time to see their patients in academic programs, for example, tend to refer less. Primary care doctors can actually manage a great deal of the standard specialty problems. That's part of the training. We used to say in my family practice program that we could treat 90% in terms of frequency of what the major specialties saw. But the problem is, currently primary care doctors receive very low pay per unit seen per patient, and therefore they need a high volume to make a decent income. That makes it more cost effective for the primary care doctor to refer more readily to expensive specialists. Now, once the patient gets to the specialist, well, there you have the get what you pay for problem. Specialists are paid to do procedures. They're paid very well. They're not paid as well to think. So if you pay people to do procedures and not to think, you might get more procedures than you otherwise would. Specialists are also sued for failing to find rare and unusual diseases. So they have a high incentive to leave no stone unturned. If you go to a gastroenterologist with a stomach ache, you will have an upper endoscopy and a lower colonoscopy. You can argue that you don't need those procedures to manage a stomach ache, but the gastroenterologist will counter quite appropriately that if they fail to find the silent cancer that's present in your body, they will be blamed as if they had given you the cancer and sued, which is also true. Not to mention the fact that they're going to make more money if they look for those diseases than if they don't. So as a result, you have kind of an unchained runaway train of cost, which no amount of just tort reform is going to fix. You actually kind of have to not send every patient with a stomach ache to a specialist in order to derail this particular runaway train. And that means having primary care doctors who have good enough compensation and enough time and enough doctors that they manage these problems. And then if the patient fails to improve, sends them to the specialist. And that just isn't happening right now. That should be happening and it's not. Another reason we need more primary care doctors is that primary care doctors are more conservative in their practice in terms of what drugs they prescribe. They're more likely to use older generic drugs. They're more likely to consider cost, and they're more likely to be aware of the side effects that patients experience because they're the one who gets the 3 a.m. phone call, not the cardiologist. We also need more resource support to coordinate care. I would love to see some sort of incentive. I would love to give a report card back to the insurance company about whether the specialists send me a report, because I spent a lot of time chasing information I should have gotten in the first place as the referring physician. But we need coordinated decision support. That means we need some good software, and that means we need all of the specialists and all of the labs coming into our primary care offices in the same form, either all paper or all electronic. But we currently do not have a coordinated information system, so you sit in a hailstorm of paperwork trying to pull together that patient's case with very poor reimbursement for doing cognitive work and no systemic support. This is all very fixable, and it's fixable cheaply, and it would do so much to drive down healthcare costs, but it's a big blind spot, and you can expect to be hearing more about this in the future. So let's go to our first caller, and that is John in Davenport. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
As I was listening to you talk about the way that the different primary care versus specialists interact, and it seems like there's a fundamental problem. It seems like we'd be better to move from fee-for-service to straight time. You pay for the time, face-to-face time with the doctor.
I think that with appropriate safeguards in place to make sure that doctors didn't abuse that, say an upper
yeah,
time limit,
of course.
I think that would be a great idea. I have been experimenting. I have two practices, as some of you know. I have a primary care practice in Scotts Valley, and I have a micro practice where I do acupuncture, and sometimes I do counseling there, or consultation, more accurately, when someone has a very complicated medical problem or they have something that's not responding. And I've taken up just charging to sit there and think. So I just charge people for my time. You know, I'm very careful about noting the time we start, and I'm careful about noting the time we stop, and I usually round down. People have been very satisfied with the ability to just sit and talk to me, you know, because I'm a smart person and I listen well and I've got a good set of brain cells and can figure things out. So, will you pay for half an hour of my time? And I walk away happy because it's fun to think and not be hassled. And they walk away happy because they've been heard and possibly gotten some well thought out solutions to some issues. I really like this kind of practice of medicine, and I would love to see Medicare pay for it. Because right now, effectively, Medicare patients in my primary care practice are essentially paying my expenses. If I lived in San Jose and had a practice there, I would make maybe a 15% profit, but because of some truly bizarre biases in reimbursement, Medicare here is reimbursed at about 22% less than it's reimbursed in Santa Clara County. Literally, you make no profit. You break even on your Medicare practice in most medical practices, certainly in mine, because I talk to people.
How did we go to the fee-for-service? Who started that?
Well, it's a good question. It all started back in 1965 when Medicare was invented. And at that point, there were prices that were set up and something called a relative value. And so the relative value of, say, doing a skin biopsy versus the relative value of talking to somebody for 10 minutes were established as a numeric value. And then you have a money number, and you simply, to figure out what something's worth, you multiply the relative value by the money number. The relative values have gotten all distorted, such that all procedures, by the way, have advocacy groups. Sitting and thinking and talking to the patient doesn't really have an advocacy group in the panel that does this. This is an AMA-dominated, appointed panel. It's not democratically elected, and primary care has essentially one vote, and ear, nose, and throat has one vote, and cardiology has one vote, and nephrology has one vote. And would you believe that over the years, procedures have, just like they do in Congress, you know, I'll vote for yours if you vote for mine, procedures have developed higher and higher relative values, and thinking has never been augmented in its relative value.
I guess a better question I might ask, who made money by switching it over that way?
I'm not sure that anybody made money. I think initially when they set up Medicare, the idea was that there were a whole lot of people out there who really needed health care and couldn't afford it.
Okay.
And at the time, there weren't nearly so many procedures. We didn't have CT scans. We didn't have MRIs. Medical care was basically x-rays and a relatively small number of drugs. And the people who needed them, which were the older people, were still going broke trying to pay for them, and they had fixed incomes. So it was set up as the Social Security money is being spent on health care. That's not fair. People shouldn't have to choose between food and health care. So we're going to fund health care for the elderly and the disabled. And that was the original mandate of Medicare. But what happened over the next 20 years is that because it was a systematized way of applying value, everybody, all the insurance companies, as insurance came in a big way, the insurance companies adopted it as the standard for how they were going to determine payment. And you created a market essentially for procedures, for high complexity procedures, and all of the old stuff that had low value kind of got dropped.
So did they adopt it because they had a way of making increased income for the insurance company?
The insurance company adopted it because it cut their costs, their administrative costs.
Okay, so they made money, in essence.
Exactly.
By reducing costs. Okay, yeah. Okay. I got it now. Okay,
yeah.
Well, thanks for your help.
You're welcome. That's why this has been a great disappointment. I mean, this quote-unquote healthcare reform, which was supposed to be at least healthcare financing reform, which isn't even that. I don't know what we could call this. I don't even want to call it healthcare reform anymore. But
reform.
The bill in Congress, let's call it the insurance mandate legislation, because that's basically all it is. It's a big Christmas present for the insurance companies. They get to get all those young people who haven't been getting insurance are now going to be required to get insurance.
Oh, boy. The masses, we have to do something, but we're not. I guess we're just too comfortable.
No, I don't blame us. I really don't. I don't think it's our fault anymore. I think we actually have a broken democracy. I'm very, very disappointed. From what I've seen, the only real solution to anything is true campaign finance reform. We simply have to get the lobbyists out of Dodge.
I agree.
That's it. That's all we have, is to get rid of the lobbyists, and I'm not holding my breath on that one. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Steve in Monterey. Hello, Steve, and welcome to the program.
Your initial discussion on the 95-year-old lady brought up an issue for me that I think a lot about in terms of current public debate, healthcare reform. My professional background is I was a registered nurse for many years, working in ICUs and ERs and, you know, critical care areas in general, and since the mid-70s. So if I were to write a book right now, I would call that book, as a takeoff on Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, I'd write a book called The Greediest Generation. My premise being that I feel that the older generation of this country is so sapping the future of our youth, my children, my grandchildren, that there's not really going to be any way for them to support this juggernaut that we have going in our society that is all based on longevity. Now, when you talk about a 95-year-old lady receiving the drug regimen that you described, my question is not, is it appropriate for her to receive imodipine versus another drug that's put forth by the pharmacies clearly just for, as you pointed out, new profit motives? Mm-hmm. Why are we prescribing that drug regimen to a 95-year-old person in the first place? From my perspective, things have just gotten so far out of hand in that regard, this whole emphasis on extending cellular function in people to the last possible minute, and it's purely driven by profits, corporate profits that have no interest in the ultimate public good.
Well, I think you should write the book. I'd love to read it, but my first thought is that we basically should blame Dr. Spock. Dr. Spock was a child care expert. His books were, you know, all about don't do corporal punishment, reason with the children. He was a very kinder, gentler sort of how to raise kids. And we ended up raising a very selfish generation. These are the children of the baby boomers, who are now kind of the sandwich generation. But their parents, which is the World War II generation in Tom Brokaw's books, who are now in their 90s, a lot of them. And so that's the generation that is getting all of this arguably excessive health care, is being supported by a generation that follows them. It's all about me, and it's about me and mom, and you don't say no to me.
Right.
You don't, you know, I'm entitled. And that sense of entitlement includes that we should be entitled to all health care that might conceivably keep us alive, but we shouldn't have to pay for it. And obviously, that is ludicrous and unsustainable. How do we find our way out of that particular paper bag, I think, is a huge question. Collapse of the healthcare system would be my prediction of how it's going to go. Literally a collapse, because all it's going to take at this point is one really good epidemic to take out the system. Because when people get really sick with that epidemic, what do we do when we're out of ventilators? What do we do when we simply can't sustain the level of care to which everyone has been accustomed, and we have a die-off? Well, there'll be all these lawsuits, and the whole thing will come to a screeching halt. Someone will have to step in legislatively with a rescue package and essentially declare martial law in the healthcare system. That's one scenario, but effectively, I'm beginning to feel like the Haiti scenario is where we're headed.
Well, if you talk about martial law, I have visions of marauding youth running around blowing up nursing homes saying, we're not going to do this anymore. I have always hoped that our society would have a discussion based on consciousness and ethics on when it's appropriate to simply allow people to gracefully exit.
And I wish we were confident enough in whatever it is that gives us spiritual strength that we could kind of look the fact that we're going to die in the face to have that discussion.
Yeah.
But I'd say that less than 10% of the people I talk to who are in a life-threatening situation are emotionally mature enough to have that discussion.
Because there has been no public discourse that's allowed people to contemplate and prepare for that eventuality. For those of us that work in the business and we see it every single day and we different, but that's what was horrifying to me about the whole death panel, terrifying people with this whole death panel. It, we, at a time when we absolutely most, in my entire life, need a rational discussion on ethics and consciousness and finances of healthcare, all those things blend together, then you have Republicans throwing out this whole death panel thing. It was just so horrifying to me. Anyway, that's a soapbox for me. I could go on about this, but thank you. I love your show, and good luck. And by the way, also, I absolutely support everything you say about primary care practitioners under siege. I work in the business end of things now, and I see it all the time. It's just terrible.
Well, thank you for that note of support. And I want to encourage you to write that book. You know, it is very easy to self-publish, and you seem like you've got a lot of really important stuff to say. Or at least start a blog. If you don't want to go through the effort of putting it on paper, you can put it on bits and send it out there, and who knows, you could go viral in a good way.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Before we go to our next caller, I want to take a little bit of a riff in another direction on my editorial just now and tell you about this story. Computerized alerts can influence drug prescribing. This was very simple little research. First of all, I want to tell you that due to the stimulus package, doctors are actually receiving financial payments from the government to start doing electronic prescribing. There's a incentive package that the feds have put out there so that doctors, particularly doctors in small practices who otherwise don't have the capital, can get almost fully reimbursed for setting up electronic prescribing. And electronic prescribing isn't a panacea. There's still going to be problems with it. You can still make errors, but it does have the potential for allowing us to track prescriptions and to put in these lovely little reminders. So this is a study done in an Indianapolis emergency room where they had a computerized order entry system for all drugs. And the researchers tracked the prescribing patterns for 63 different emergency room physicians, and then they set up a decision support program. And how this worked was that orders for 9 different drugs that are probably not a good idea to give to people over 65, promethazine, which is a commonly used anti-vomiting drug, diazepam, which is Valium, propoxypine, diphenhydramine, and 5 other drugs, generated a computer alert. And it would basically come up on the screen and say, your patient is over 65. The following drugs are safer for this purpose than the one you have prescribed. Do you want to make a substitution? Yes, no, and you click through it and then continue to write your prescription. So this was looking at those 9 drugs. And over 2 years, they dropped the number of patients receiving inappropriate medication from 4% to 2.5%. So sometimes it's quote-unquote inappropriate on the books, but it's the right drug for that patient. And I do support that the physician should be able to make the call. Physicians do know best compared to the computer program. But it's nice to have the little reminder saying, oh, by the way, would you like to do this or would you consider doing this? It's like, would you like fries with that, or the Amazon thing where people who rented this movie also rented this movie? There's nothing wrong with that. And sometimes that can take you in a good direction. As long as it's not too much trouble to get through those screens, people will actually read them. Another study in Boston looked at 4 heavily advertised hypnotic drugs, which would be Ambien, CR, Sonata, Lunesta, and Rosaram. You've seen the ads. I won't go through that with you. But they basically had an alert, which would come up when you tried to order those drugs, say, did you know that Ambien's available as generic Zolpidem? Would you like to try that? Zolpidem, rather. Or Trazodone? Those are good, and they're much, much cheaper. And you could click through it. And during that year, if you were in the intervention group, you got a lot less of those four advertised drugs being prescribed. Doctors did go, oh, yeah, there's a generic for that now. Let me use the generic. It'll be cheaper for the patient. Because there is no significant superiority to these extremely expensive drugs. It's like if you went to the supermarket to buy coffee and the generic Colombian coffee was $4 a pound and the brand Colombian coffee was $34 a pound, I think you'd bring yourself to buy the generic. I don't think most of us would buy a coffee that was literally seven times more expensive. It might be a little better, but it's not seven times better. Let's get real here. And that's about the disconnect here with the drugs. So something easy, something that makes a big difference, set up the reminders. Why not? We could do that as a policy statement. The intervention that the feds have started by encouraging electronic medical records could be tweaked a little bit such that all of these electronic prescribing programs did bias towards the generic and offer a generic substitution every time someone wrote a proprietary agent. We could save a lot of money that way, and it would not adversely influence patient care. Let's go to Gloria. Hello, Gloria in Ben Lomond.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about calcium supplements. I've taken the calcium with magnesium, and it doesn't agree with me. And I was told that there is a thing on the market that you can bathe in, and you absorb through the body, the calcium absorbed through the body. Do you know anything about that?
Not aware of the calcium being absorbed. There is some absorption of magnesium. If you bathe in Epsom salts, you might remember your mother or your grandmother using Epsom salts for sore muscles. And the magnesium in Epsom salts does actually penetrate the skin a little bit. And so you can't get toxic on it. You don't absorb that much. But I'm not aware of absorbing calcium through the skin. Might be possible. But, you know, I'd kind of want to see the data on that before recommending it. Have you tried using a calcium that's in a liquid form that's already dissociated, like the ionic calciums?
No, I haven't, but I will try.
Do you live, you live in Ben Lomond. I don't know if they carry this at your local health food store. There is a compounding pharmacy on 41st called Loudon's, which I really like. They're not a sponsor of this program, but they have a powdered form of calcium, which dissolves very well in warm water and kind of tastes like milk tea with a little lemon in it. Not a bad taste at all. And I think you could get your calcium in that way without triggering diarrhea.
Well, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Good luck
to
you. Let me know.
Bye-bye.
We had an off-air question about probiotics from last week's interview. What time of the day is best to take probiotics? And the answer to that is anytime you can consistently manage to do it, with or without food. They might be a little better absorbed with food, but it can't be with very hot food, and it shouldn't be with very hot liquids, because that will tend to inactivate some of the bacteria. And any other comments about taking probiotics? I think consistency is very, very important. And I like to suggest the use of high-dose probiotics that contain a variety of organisms. So I generally tell my patients, you want at least 3 billion colony-forming units of at least 5 different organisms, and 2 of them should be bifidobacterium and 2 of them should be lactobacillus species. And that will sort of get you the kind of ground cover ecological balancing effect that we're after with the probiotics. There are certain species that have been scientifically validated as being particularly useful for a particular disease. And so some doctors are going with, okay, you have to use this strain at, you know, this dose. And while that's very scientific, I actually think it's somewhat wrong-headed because what we're trying to do is recreate or support a complex system. And yes, if you're going to do science, you have to isolate variables. But in reality, we're not trying to isolate variables. And I just don't think megadosing with single probiotic species is a really valid approach for most of us. And we're going straight to Steve in Santa Cruz. Hello, Steve, and welcome to the program.
Morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, I was just listening. I didn't catch the beginning of what you're talking about in terms of doctors going online to write prescriptions and being prompted to consider alternatives or even consider generics. What came to mind for me was I just can't help wondering and wondered if you could speak to the notion of pharmaceutical companies lobbying against something like that because suggesting doctors go away from brand names to generics. And then the other thought was, during this process, when they go from screen to screen to screen, is there an opportunity for advertising where if your doctor is prescribing an antibiotic or something like that, they could get, you know, little banner ads of that would show them, you know, an ad for a specific brand.
Right, and that would be a bad thing, don't you think?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, I think
the lobbying of the pharmaceutical company to say, no, you know, you can't have this, or we don't want you to do this, and whatever.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right on. And the answer is, I think, that you can anticipate that the pharmaceutical companies would very much lobby against anything that required these sorts of pop-ups for generics when an expensive drug is being prescribed. Like, oh, you've written a prescription for Allegra. Did you know that generic fexafenidine is available? I mean, it's not like when the generics come out, there's any kind of big thing. And furthermore, another little detail, a little dirty little secret of the pharmaceutical industry is that now, in a kind of Tony Soprano-like move, the pharmaceutical companies will actually pay the generic companies not to produce the generic. So when the generic drugs are developed by, let's say, Bar Pharmaceuticals, B-A-R-R, is a company that makes a lot of generics. So let's suppose they develop a generic version of, pick a drug, something we don't have a generic for, Don, like an ARB. So they develop a generic ARB, which would be great because this is a very good blood pressure medication. I'd love to have a generic. And then the company that makes Hyzaar comes to them and says, you know what? We will pay you $60 million not to produce your generic. You've got it approved through the FDA. You can go ahead and make it, but when you're going to have to make it, you're going to have to market it. How would you just like $60,000 to just sit tight and do nothing, or
right,
$60 million? And that's
what they might make if they sold the product.
Well, let's suppose that it's what they would net.
Yeah.
Hello, this is corporate business. That should be illegal. Okay, that's like, we just outlaw that right out. You're not allowed to do that. Okay, it's an anti-competitive practice. It's against the law. End of discussion. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. Medicare Part D, okay? We got a drug benefit. Does anybody remember Medicare Part D? This was rammed through at 3 a.m. by a Republican-dominated Congress, and it was full of flaws, including the donut hole, which everyone knew was going to be an absolute disaster and is, because people very happily, you know, this 95-year-old lady who's on the three drugs, along about, oh, June or so, she's going to find out that her drugs are costing her $500 a month. At that point, they're going to get, even if you start switching her to generics at that point, you're still going to get $1,000, $1,500 of her money before the Medicare kicks back in again, because that's what the donut hole is. It was supposed to encourage people to go with cheaper generic drugs. That was the rationale. But the way they set it up essentially meant the person falls into a hole and then realizes that they need cheap generics. And it's too late. You can't turn on a dime on a 95-year-old lady on four meds. I mean, I'm not going to change all four meds. I'm going to change one and then come back in a week and maybe change a second and so on. I can't do an old car. I'll kill it. You know, you just can't do that. So meanwhile, they're making their profits. When we got this latest, quote unquote, healthcare finance reform, let's call it the insurance mandate because that's a more accurate term for the legislation we're going to get. But when they were talking about the insurance mandate, you can bet that the pharmaceuticals took out what would have been the single one provision that would have paid for healthcare reform. Absolutely, positively, do the math. Congressional Budget Office said so too. You simply can import drugs from Canada. Okay? The Canadians can buy drugs way cheaper because they buy as a national purchasing pool. They're like mega Costco. You know, they've got purchasing power. So they can get a really good price for drugs, and they do. And all we would have to do is buy them from Canada. Canada could buy twice as many and sell them to us. Canada could make a profit, and we'd still save money. Or we could actually create a United States Medicare purchasing pool. That would be heresy, of course, in a market-driven economy. But if we did that, we could get these drugs really cheap, and the money that we'd saved would pay for all of the anticipated shortfalls in Medicare for the next 20 years. The guy who called who said, you know, the system's going to crash because of the older people, the demographic shift. Well, we could fund that if we just leveraged our buying ability as a nation. We're huge. But we don't. And we don't because our legislature is in the pocket of special interest groups, including the pharmaceutical agencies. And why are they in the pocket? They're in the pocket because they have to get reelected. And they can't get reelected without a whole lot of money. And until we fix that, we're never going to get this thing cleaned up, short of a total collapse. Sorry, I'll climb off the soapbox now.
All good stuff.
Take a deep breath. But anyway, that's kind of what's going on, as far as I'm concerned. It would be really interesting to practice medicine rationally. And could we outlaw the direct-to-consumer ads, please, while we're on the subject of ways to keep prices down? If people don't know that there's such, that there's this wonderful product that has a lovely association with walking on the beach, then they won't ask for it, and I won't have to spend 5 minutes, which I don't get paid for, talking them out of it. I try to be a good citizen here, a good world citizen, but it gets difficult sometimes.
Well, all those ads, they're all walking on the beach. They're all playing tennis. They're all doing the same thing.
And then they get that really fast voiceover telling you all the possible things that can, your eyeballs can fall out.
Yeah.
At least they make them talk about those. But the trouble is that the side effects are so horrendous when they're framed that way that it kind of backfires in a bizarre fashion.
Yeah, well, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, thank you anyway for the call.
Thank you, Don.
Bye-bye. This from Stephen in Carmel Valley. I'm a 58-year-old male, and I've had perhaps 3 bouts of prostatitis over the years, with it being treated by my urologist with antibiotics. Diagnosis is typically achieved after a digital exam and an interview. Currently, this treatment is 10 days of Cipro. I have a number of questions about this condition. If it's an infection, where did it come from, and can I pass the bacteria to my wife and thereby reinfect myself? If I didn't take an antibiotic, would my immune system eventually destroy the microbe? So let me take those two first. Prostatitis is an infection. Bacteria generally come from the rectum, and the prostate's a bit of a sponge, and so it is easy for it to become colonized, if you will, with bacteria, just like you get mold in your kitchen sponge if you don't squeeze it out properly. This is generally treated with antibiotics, and is most of the time, the 10 days will be effective in eliminating prostatitis. If it recurs quickly, then you sit like sinus infection, you just didn't get rid of all the bacteria. If it recurs a couple of months or a year later, it's probably a different infection. If you don't take an antibiotic, the immune system might eventually destroy the microbe, but generally chronic prostatitis was fairly common prior to the advent of antibiotics. And if anybody's ever read The Green Mile, the prison guard who's the hero in that, that's what he has. He has chronic prostatitis. And he has just a terrible time describing his symptoms in that excellent book by Stephen King. So for a little bit of a literary recommendation, I think that's a very, very good book. Why does the doctor recommend that I limit ingestion of acidic products like coffee, wine, and tea? Basically because there is an association with it being harder to clear infections when you're taking acidic products. I'm not sure the mechanism like that, but it probably has to do with relative inactivation of the antibiotic, either by reducing the amount of penetrance into the prostate or otherwise affecting its physiology. Doctors say I will probably be prone to this condition. What makes this the case? It's basically statistical. You've had 3 prostatitis infections, therefore you're more likely to have a 4th. It's just like if you've had 1 heart attack, you're way more likely to have another. Could it be related to congestion in the prostate, scar tissue, enlargement? Absolutely, all of the above. Does this tendency make me more likely to develop prostate cancer? That, fortunately, is no. Chronic prostatitis, untreated by antibiotics back in the 1930s, maybe. But nowadays, with antibiotic therapy, it is generally not considered to be a risk factor for prostate cancer. Just being a 58-year-old male is enough of a risk factor for that, I'm afraid. This next email from Julia I'm inquiring about trigeminal neuralgia. My aunt has just been diagnosed with it. And what Julia tells us, I'm going to abbreviate her email, is that she had it a little bit 4 years ago, then it went away. Recently, it came back at a time when she was under a great deal of stress. Apparently, her husband, who was very healthy in his 80s, still going to work, has developed heart disease and has now become very much an invalid. And so she's now doing full-time nursing for him. Her life has transformed utterly. And now she has this terrible facial pain, which occurs and essentially renders her unable to move her face without suffering sharp needle-like pain. And as you can imagine, this has affected her quality of life quite profoundly. When I approach a patient with trigeminal neuralgia or tic douloureux, one of the first things I do is start them on a low-dose anti-herpes medication because there is fairly good evidence of an association. I also, depending on where they live, will check for Lyme disease because there is an association there. I will try generic versions of anti-seizure drugs. Anti-seizure drugs work by calming the brain, which is a nerve, or rather a collective of nerves. So if you can calm the nerve, the trigeminal nerve, which is irritated, using these anti-seizure medications, you can get a good improvement of the pain without having as much constipation and sedation as you get with the use of narcotics. Also, I have found acupuncture to be helpful in the management of a lot of difficult-to-treat facial pains, and this includes temporomandibular joint and trigeminal neuralgia. So I strongly recommend trying it for those indications, and there are a number of ways to get acupuncture in Santa Cruz County. We have an acupuncture college here, Five Branches, which is just coincidentally in this very building, and therefore, a lot of graduates, as well as a student clinic here that does low-cost treatments if your aunt has difficulties there. I don't know where she lives, but if she's not local, she should definitely look into acupuncture as a possible treatment. They do not need to put needles directly into her face. They can use the opposite side of her face, which is not painful. So it isn't necessarily going to be a bad experience for her. And the last thing I would say is that this may be a message from her body that she needs respite care. Often in a situation like this, the formerly very independent man who's now bedbound or close to it, there's a very much a reluctance to have anybody take care of him but his wife. You just need to nip that in the bud. Somebody needs to get in the guy's face and say, no, you're going to have a caregiver because your wife deserves to not be your nurse all the time. It's going to kill her. And then where will you be? You'll be in a nursing home. And that is usually a good 1-2 threat, you know. Say no, remind him that he's supposed to protect his wife, and then threaten him with where will you be without her. That will usually get them to come around as a strategy. So I hope you can frame that in a less direct, more subtle way to your aunt and help her with her very difficult situation. Let's go to Marianne in Felton. Hello, Marianne. Welcome to the program.
Hello, and thank you very much for taking my call.
What can I do for you?
Well, my mother-in-law, she's 85, almost 86, and she's been living with us for 2.5 years. I had called you on the weekend of her moving in. She has Alzheimer's, but I call it the slow-moving one, so she, you know, hasn't really progressed very quickly at all. So she used to be on Exelon and Namenda, but we've gotten her off it in the last 8 months. Really not much change, you know. Once in a while you can tell she's going into the next stage. She's on Vermapramil and Aganox from a stroke 15 years ago and a low-dosage thyroid that we give to her at night. My question would be is she does a lot of sleeping.
Yes.
And, we've taken her off the meds. We thought that might help. It helped a little bit at first, but then she's back to practicing for the big sleep, as she calls it. So
it's normal for people with Alzheimer's to sleep as much as 18 hours a day. It's almost like they go back to the newborn. Remember when you had a little baby and they would, newborns, I sometimes will get calls from first-time parents who are worried because their baby sleeps all the time. And it's like, count your blessings, lady. really, it's normal for newborns to have long, frequent sleeps, you know, 3 to 4 hours of sleep, awake and alert for 15, 20 minutes, and then back to sleep. And as you get deeper and deeper into Alzheimer's disease, some people do revert to that pattern. It's normal. Essentially, if she sleeps in the chair, she sleeps in the chair. Just kind of, you have to just make sure that she's in a chair she can't slump out of. So something with arms. And in general, people will just sleep, and that's okay. Let them do it.
It's okay.
It's a slow shutdown is what's happening with her. She is practicing for the big sleep, and it's okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because we thought about, you know, talking to the neurologist. Because I was just concerned that that was part of the brain that was being eaten away since she had her stroke in the top of her
I don't think either of those drugs are having any effect on her drowsiness. I think it's just a natural progression of the disease.
So then, if she doesn't wake up till 12, 1 in the afternoon, and you give her her first set of pills and then give her second set at 7, should we try to separate it more? Or?
Well, if she's taking those pills twice a day, is that right?
Correct. One for Apomelin and a half one at night, and then Agonox is 1 and 1.
Yeah, separate them by 12 hours.
If you can. Yeah, but the problem, she's sleeping for 16.
Well, wake her up. Wake her up. Give her pill. It's time for your pills, Mom. Okay. You know, she'll take the, you know, sit her up, give her the water, give her the pill, and let her go back to sleep.
Okay. So it's all right without the food, probably.
Yes.
She drinks coffee pretty well. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. Great.
Bye-bye. We're going to try to squeeze in Patty in SoCal. Patty, we've got just a few minutes, but hopefully we can help you out here.
Hi. I have a skin condition called Grover's disease or transient acantholytic dermatosis. I've been told there's no cure, but it is transient. It can go away in 6 to 12 months and it can come back. And it consists of little sort of like blisters that are very, very itchy.
Mm-hmm.
And the only treatment I have is triamcinolone and then trying to keep my body cool because it's, and I don't sweat anymore. So I have the feeling that that's contributing to why my body is hot.
Is this something that happens all over the body when you get it? Or is it in like your hands?
It's mainly on my trunk, everywhere on my back. And it's sort of migrating to the front of me and partly on my legs and my arms.
And what frequency does it occur?
Well, it sort of flares up twice a day. And
then you ever have periods of time when you don't have it at all?
Yeah. After I use the triamcinolone, it will calm down. Mm-hmm. Or I end up with cold shower afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But I find at night that I sit watching TV or Netflix with an ice pack on my back.
Right.
And mainly stripping off most clothes, wearing the softest cotton I can, but it just can really drive you crazy.
When I see people with odd periodic skin things, now that I've become a functional medicine physician, which causes you to think in terms of could there be some outside input that's driving this,
right.
I will usually encourage people to go on an elimination diet and keep a food diary. And,
okay.
And so if you will email me, just go to the AskDrDawn.com website.
Okay.
And email me from there. I will send you an elimination diet and you would do that plus a food diary for about a month and see if your symptoms change.
Okay.
Okay.
Great, and I've been trying to pay more attention to that in case it did have.
Yeah, you won't figure it out because the delay can be 3 or 4 days.
Yeah,
it's too hard.
Right.
You have to get really lucky to figure it out. What we do is we essentially eliminate the things that are the most common, and we hope it's one of them.
Okay,
it's like if someone comes in with runny nose, I ask them, "Do you have cats?" Hamster allergies are rare. Cat allergies are common. So it's along that line. It's a good seat of the pants medicine, which maybe could help and is definitely worth a try. So you send me that email, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it looks like the clock on the clubhouse wall is telling us that it's time to go. And points, extra points for anybody who figures out what I'm referring to. And you're definitely dating yourself if you do. So I hope you've enjoyed this hour of Dr. Dawn, and I hope you'll come back next week. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.